The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Melissa Schilling. Dr. Schilling is the John Herzog Family Professor of Management and Organization at New York University's Stern School of Business. She's one of the world's leading researchers in the innovation strategy of cutting-edge industries such as smartphones, computers, software, video games, biotech, renewable energy, and electric vehicles. She has published in the Harvard Business Review and numerous leading academic journals. Her new book is called Quirky, The Remarkable Story of the Traits, Foibles, and Genius of Breakthrough Innovators Who Changed the World. Melissa Schilling, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm fascinated by the academic study of creativity. In our work with the behavioral scientists at the Booth School of Business, we're constantly battling about things like, are individuals more creative by themselves or within groups? And with your new book, Quirky, you are making a pivot from the way creativity is most often studied. Looking at creativity, you write, quote, most of that research has focused on the general process of creativity, how ordinary people use creativity to solve problems. For example, rather than telling us why some people become outliers. So what is the total spin on that?
Well, you know, the thing is, in our field, there are certain norms of what you can publish and what you can't publish. And traditionally, you either wanted to do a large sample study, something big and empirical that you could run statistics on, or you wanted to do a laboratory study. Mm-hmm. And it turns out neither of those is very well suited to figuring out what causes creative genius, because even in a large sample, you could have nobody that was, an outstanding stellar genius. And you also can't get creative geniuses into the laboratory. And yet, really important to study, because there are some things that you only realize after you've seen them in their extreme. And I got to say, the person who taught me the most about that in this project was Nikola Tesla, because Nikola Tesla had traits just dialed up to such a high level that you notice them when you would have never noticed them before. And once you did notice them and you started to hunt for them, the other people, they all have them. They just didn't have them to that extreme level.
That's really interesting. So, like, the group would hide those sorts of things because they are so unusual.
Yeah, well, and yeah, and the other thing is that, you know, I end up concluding in the book, and I'm not the first person to conclude this, there's a lot of psychology research on this, but groups are actually not that great for creativity. I mean, if you're looking for, they're not, when I first said that, I'm in a management department, and right. In a management department, everything is supposed to be groups. You have the students work in groups, you only study groups or organizations, you never study individuals.
Right.
So it was almost heretical to say that, but there's actually quite a bit of psychology research studying this question, and basically there's sort of three main processes. The first thing to eliminate is not that there's free riders. So people used to assume that in a group, the problem would be that some people just free ride and decide not to be creative because they can count other people doing that. There isn't much support for that hypothesis, but there's a lot of support for the other hypotheses, which is that, first of all, a lot of people are afraid to put their craziest stuff out in front of others.
Mm-hmm.
They have what's called evaluation apprehension.
Right.
And that means when you're in a group, you're mostly contributing ideas that you think other people are already going to agree with. You don't put your unusual, heterodox, breakthrough ideas out there. And then the second thing that happens is that it's called production blocking. And that means when I'm talking, you're not talking, right? You're not getting to say your idea, and you're not even able to really think about your idea. When I'm talking, I'm essentially hijacking your thought process and bringing you to my idea instead of letting you elaborate your idea. So that's going to get rid of a lot of ideas right there. But the third thing I found which has not even been something that's really been studied heavily, but when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. And the person who really reveals this to you in a way is Steve Jobs, is that most people are afraid of conflict. Most people avoid conflict. So when they're in a group and someone disagrees with them, they make concessions.
Right.
And in that process of making concessions, they end up sanding off all the corners off of their idea. You know, they make their idea less unusual, less original.
So what's fascinating about all this, right, because it's absolutely true, but this is the reason that Second City gets hired to bring improv training into businesses, because the reality of what we teach is making mistakes work for you, being others focused, you know, embracing failure. So the entire sort of like philosophy is like nudges around how to work well in groups. And what I'd suggest,
right,
where the studying, this is what hasn't been studied. Like, they haven't studied the Second City ensemble with Tina Fey and Rachel Dratch and Scott Adsit that's been together for 2 years that is functioning at such a high level. Or I think you'd see the same thing in like a great jazz combo or, you know, a great basketball team, because those people learn. But, you know, you're absolutely correct, because most group interaction is kind of terrible.
Right. That's funny. Yeah. And I guess one thing that you're pointing out that, you know, I didn't really look at, but the degree to which, if you bring in a group like Second City, which is used to taking risks and has already developed a system for tolerating failure, that can be moving the needle in the right direction for an organization.
We hope so. That's paying the bills. So we'll move on from that. But I was just interested in it because obviously it's on our mind. One of the things I love about this book is the sort of the cross-section of ideas that tie these people together. And you kind of claim them all as outsiders. And you say, outsiders aren't trapped by the paradigms and assumptions that become calcified in industry veterans. So, in fact, this is kind of that idea that, like, expertise can sometimes get in a way, but not for these people.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I had read the book Outliers just a couple of years before Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers book. And he picks up on this same argument that Herb Simon had made years ago. The person needs something like 10,000 units of expertise in an area before they can really contribute to it.
Right.
And I found pretty much the opposite in the people that I studied. I mean, Steve Jobs had relatively little computer training when he started contributing to computers. And Elon Musk had almost no training in rocket science when he decided he was going to build reusable rockets. Dean Kamen doesn't have a medical background at all. In fact, he doesn't even have an undergraduate degree, and yet invented some, you know, staggeringly important medical inventions. And you know, these people proved over and over again that not always, but often, someone who's completely outside a field who's going to bring a fundamentally different way of looking at it, which makes sense when you think about it, right? Because when you're in a field, you get indoctrinated in the paradigm. And look at someone like Einstein. I mean, Einstein was trained as a physicist, but he argued that the reason he was able to have his revolutionary findings was because he was essentially rejected by academia,
right?
He couldn't get an academic post. He ended up working as a patent clerk, and he had very little to lose by ignoring the norms of academia. So he threw away all these Newtonian concepts that were holding other people back and ended up saying some things that were incredibly controversial and new and that were at first, you know, treated with serious skepticism, but then they turned out to be right, and it completely changed physics.
Yeah, I love it. You the phrase that he gave himself where he says, "I gang my own gate," which is really, and it felt like he has a kind of a self-awareness of many of these figures who maybe don't, all of them. It seems like he had a sense of humor about himself.
Yeah, he is the one who he's the one who most articulated this clear understanding both of how detached he was from people and how it benefited him. And you learn so much just from reading his own words about how, you know, he even felt detached from his family, you know, but he believed it made him a more independent thinker. And he ended up telling other people, you know, be a loner because that enables you to pursue the truth.
Yeah, I was talking about your book to some colleagues, and they're like, oh, yeah, these guys are all introverts. But no, actually, you're saying this sort of social detachment is different than introversion.
Yeah, I don't think introversion is the right dimension. In fact, this study actually made me question the introversion-extroversion dimension altogether, because these people have, they're often socially awkward. They might seek to spend a lot of time alone, but some of the traits we would associate with introversion just don't line up with these people. So, for instance, they're often very assertive.
Hmm.
You know, Steve Jobs was incredibly assertive, and Steve Jobs would not be labeled an introvert by a typical personality scale. So they're assertive, they might have very strong views, and they might enjoy telling people about their ideas, and yet they felt disconnected from the world in a way that made its rules not apply to them. I mean, I actually think that the personality trait we ought to take a closer look at, and I think anyone's really explored this, is there's a personality trait known as agreeableness.
Hmm.
And I'd say most of these introverts, most of these innovators would have scored very low on agreeableness.
Yeah.
But not to mean that they're just surly, but rather they don't capitulate. You know, they don't do things just to get along.
Yeah.
They stood up for their ideas, even when people thought they were weird or wrong.
Yeah, I've worked with some people like that. So the other thing that's interesting in this section is you say that many studies show that immigrants start up new companies at twice the rate of natives. So that's another kind of separateness in terms of you're being in a whole different country.
Right, exactly. This old finding called the marginal man hypothesis, which basically meant that the people who stood at the periphery of a social circle were more likely to introduce new ideas and to also take bigger risks and engage in entrepreneurship. And in part, it's because they're bringing a different knowledge set and they don't belong, so just fundamentally they're not going to come in with the same norms. In part, it's also because they have less to lose. So since they don't have all that social capital built up in the group, there's less to lose by being unconventional. So there's a lot of pieces here.
Yep. You mentioned earlier, too, that sort of traditional educational, higher educational models were often sort of eschewed by these folks. So, you know, like Steve Jobs and Dean Kamen both dropped out of college. But that doesn't, they didn't take that route, but they were still learning. And one thing was like a love of books, right? These guys read a lot.
Yeah. Yes. This is a really super interesting finding, I thought, because I think it has huge implications for education. A lot of the people in my set had a lot less formal education than you would expect, and even the ones that had formal education often struggled with the structure of it.
Hmm.
So even someone like Elon Musk, you know, who's a brilliant, brilliant man and got two undergraduate degrees, didn't actually do a graduate degree, but he says, you know, he felt really constrained by the curriculum, and he would just show up to take the tests. He never went to class. And Albert Einstein was also, you know, a brilliant person and extremely advanced in mathematics, but professors found him disrespectful and irreverent, and he often also didn't come to class or came to class late. So even the people that had higher education struggled with the structure of it. But I think the lesson there is it was the structure, not the education, because all of them were insatiable readers, just voracious appetites for reading. And they wanted to study and learn, but they wanted to study and learn the topics they chose and at the depth they wanted and at the speed they wanted. And they wanted to move across fields at the rhythm they wanted. And the more you think about it, the more you realize that, of course, we all have different sets of preferences for how we learn. We have different ways of learning best and different ways of enjoying learning. And so sometimes the standard structure that's being given to us in school just doesn't match the way we learn or what we want to learn.
Yeah. And I wonder, too, if a part of it might be this speculation that many of these figures could maybe be on the autism spectrum.
Yeah, there were some interesting signs of that. You know, here's an interesting thing. You know, both Albert Einstein and Elon Musk were so introspective as children that people thought they were deaf and had them tested for deafness.
Wow.
I mean, you have to be pretty seriously introspective for your parents to think you're deaf.
Yeah, I'd say. Wow.
And Nikola Tesla had this severe sensitivity to stimuli that would be very consistent with autism, in that, you know, he said that when a fly would land on a table, the thud would hurt his ears, or that any light from the sun would just sear his eyes, and he was just incredibly sensitive, and he had lots of obsessive-compulsive traits and lots of signs of mania. It was pretty interesting. And, you know, and then several of them had some difficulty emotionally relating with others. You know, Steve Jobs could be very, very charismatic, but Chrisanne Brennan, the mother of his child, described him as having this incredibly emotional woodenness, right? And he was a person who knew how to read people. He had empathy, but he often chose to use that empathy against people. We often associate empathy with sympathy. We think if you're empathetic, you're going to be kind. But it's altogether possible to be empathetic, meaning you understand how people feel, without being kind. And that's how Steve Jobs often exhibited empathy in sort of a instrumental form.
And this is what's so interesting of this like weird cocktail mix that you've discovered, because you've got on the one hand separateness, right? And you've got, they might even be on the spectrum, but then they have to, they all have sort of this self efficacy, which you wouldn't think they'd have given the other stuff. There's this kind of like early success thing that's going on. How is that working?
Yeah. So a lot of people only know about confidence, generalized confidence, which is this sort of overall sense that you're doing well in the world, and it might include things like you feel good about how you look and you feel good about your relationships with others. A lot of these people didn't have that. Like, I don't think Marie Curie would have come across as a confident person. But there's this one type of confidence, a specific task-related form of self-confidence called self-efficacy that they all had in spades. So they all had extreme self-efficacy. And self-efficacy is when you believe in your ability to overcome obstacles to achieve your goals. And people with extremely high self-efficacy will take on things that other people deem impossible. And they look like they're risk-tolerant, but they're not actually risk-tolerant. It's just calculus. A risk is totally different if you don't believe you can fail, right?
Yeah.
And I think that Elon Musk is just an iconic example of this. I mean, this is a guy who found out that NASA wasn't going to take us to Mars and decided, well, all right, roll up my sleeves and I'll take us to Mars myself. And then even after people like Neil Armstrong and the entire space industry said, look, kid, we've done this. We've tried. We've spent 50 years trying to create a reusable rocket. It is impossible. Give it up. He just shrugged and said, I think I can do it. And he did it. You know, it's amazing.
I know you quote Scott Pelley at CBS saying only four entities have launched a space capsule into orbit and successfully brought it back: the United States, Russia, China, and Elon Musk. That's incredible. The sort of, you're also talking about mental modeling, right? This idea, what these folks are doing, and you use the term, and I don't think I'd heard it before, hero stories. They're like making themselves the hero in the story.
Right. You know, there's two main ways that you can build self-efficacy and get that sense that you can overcome obstacles. And the first one is early wins. So, you know, having some experience of overcoming obstacles and achieving your goals teaches you something about yourself. And that's why it's so important to let kids work out problems on their own if you think they can, or, you know, with your employees or your friends around. So sometimes we want to rush in to help people the minute they start to struggle because that's really good for social bonding.
Right.
But it denies them a chance to create self-efficacy. So sometimes the best thing you can come back and say, hey, you know what? I have faith in you. You got this. You can figure it out. I'm sure you can do it. But then the second piece, which is the part you're referring to, is vicarious learning. And this is really interesting because it's super easy to take advantage of. Anyone can take advantage of this. Basically, humans are wired for social learning, right? As a species, we're an interdependent species, and we don't figure out that the berry will kill by eating it. We figure out that the berry will kill us if it killed somebody else. We know what we can jump over and what we can climb up, and we learn a lot about what we can do just from watching what others do. You can tap that. You can take advantage of it to build self-efficacy by reading hero stories. So, you know, having kids read hero stories or reading hero stories yourself, where you pick someone that you can identify with in some way, I mean, not some superhero, but some person who's not too much different from you, and read about how they overcame obstacles to achieve their goals. And when you do that, you learn something about yourself. And that's extremely, extremely valuable and so easy to do.
Wow, that's really interesting. So I want to talk to you about a thing that is all over this book, and it's all over our work, and it's this idea around failure. So we talk about this a lot at Second City, because what you have to do in the world of comedy writ large, but improvisation probably even larger, is you fail a ton because you're co-creating groups, there's different audiences, all that stuff. So you have to build up this incredible it's not even just a tolerance for failure. It's kind of a love of it. Stephen Colbert always says, learning to love to bomb, you know, and so you have this sort of like shared resilience. And the stand-ups always make fun of us because they're like, yeah, it's easy, you know, for you guys to go fail because you all have each other to, you know, hang out together afterwards, but we do it by ourselves. And they're not wrong. And all of these innovators share the ability to persist in the face of obstacles or failures.
Yep. You know, they really have that philosophy that each no is just one step closer to a yes. You know, they Thomas Edison probably is the most archetypal example here, where somebody once came in and expressed sympathy about the fact that he had tried 10,000 ways to build a new storage battery. He was trying to build a better storage battery initially for the electric car. And he just failed and failed and failed and failed. And his friends came in and felt really bad for him and said, you know, how do you get through with all this failure? And Thomas Edison looked at him with this quizzical expression on his face of surprise and said, what are you talking about? I've found 10,000 ways that won't work. I haven't failed. Right? He saw each of those failures as just a step to finding the solution. And he enjoyed the process. He was just a consummate learning by doing kind of person.
Right. And didn't I don't know if I saw this in your book or my friend Neil might have told me this, that Edison once tried to build a contraption to catch ghosts. I heard that. And I also heard he had an idea for low income housing that was all made out of cinder blocks.
You know, it's possible. He had so many ideas. He was really prone to flitting from one idea to the other. In fact, some people would probably the biggest criticism that's made of him as an inventor is that he often didn't stick with things. He got bored with things, and he liked to move from one thing to the other. A lot of people assume that he was very materialistic because he was very interested in patenting things. But the truth is, he just liked to accumulate patents. He didn't care that much about money. And so he would move from project to project to project. The most notorious one probably would be the fact that he had actually developed the phonograph, but never brought it to market. And then eventually Alexander Graham Bell brought it to market.
Wow!
But yeah, he had lots of different interesting projects.
Yeah, I want to talk. I want to actually. I didn't have this in my notes, but you brought it up. The money thing. So this is interesting because that is also a shared quality where there was not a profit motive for these folks, and in fact, a lot of them like just gave their stuff away.
Right. Like Marie Curie gave away all of her awards, all of her grants. Anytime she had a little extra money, she just gave it back to whatever institution she was working with or to some other younger scholar who needed the money. And she also never patented any of her discoveries because she believed that anything she discovered should be there for the good of humanity. I think some people often assume that Elon Musk is very money-oriented, too, which I find absolutely hilarious, because if you study him, if you really study his life, there's no way you could draw that conclusion. He does not care about money at all. I don't think he's cared about money since the sale of PayPal to eBay when he had about $180 million. And at that point, he could have just retired and drank mojitos on the beach or something, but he decided he wanted to figure out what would change the world in the most meaningful way. And he put $100 million of his own money into SpaceX, and he put $50 million of his own money into Tesla. He pretty much gambled everything. Gambled is the wrong word, but he invested everything he had into those companies and was ready to lose it all because, you know, he knew there was a very high probability that both of those companies would fail. And, you know, he recently announced he's not going to take any compensation from Tesla for the next 10 years. Hmm. I mean, any compensation, not even stock options, nothing. And even at the end of 10 years, he's only going to get compensated if the company reaches a market valuation of $650 billion.
Wow.
And that's 10 times the size of General Motors. So he has said, I'm not going to take any money out of Tesla unless it hits a size that is 10 times the size of General Motors. I mean, who does that?
Right. We've talked on this podcast before about this idea that I've been kicking around with friends about. We talk about all the sort of innovative work that's come out of Chicago, specifically in the arts. So things like improvisation, the blues, house music, the sort of spoken word. And the thing that ties all those things together is you can't own them. They are unownable art forms. You can't own an improvisation. You know, it just happens. And blues are the same chords over and over again. And, you know, and house music is appropriating other people's music, right? It's like, and I wonder too if there's something in that, in the spirit of innovation, the place where it can happen is non-transactional.
Yeah. You know what I think it is also is that intrinsic motivation is just inherently more creative than extrinsic motivation.
Oh, that's a really good point. It might be as simple as that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, you have an outlier in this book, I think, which is Benjamin Franklin. I mean, like everyone else is moaning and groaning and, you know, like having bad relationships. And this guy is like he'd have the most friends on Facebook if Benjamin Franklin was alive. I mean, like he's so gregarious. What's the deal? I'm curious about you including him because it doesn't seem to tie with some of the others, but it does in some ways.
Well, you know, the thing is I was very careful in my selection process. I set up criteria and followed them. I didn't want to pick people based on their adherence or lack of adherence to a particular theme. That would have biased the research process. And I'm a researcher. Fundamentally, I'm a researcher. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to use an empirical process where I was not biasing it. And so I tried to get myself out of the selection process as much as possible. And, and he was in there. And I actually, when I entered the research project, I didn't know separateness was going to be this theme. And it turned out to be an incredibly strong theme, and I hadn't anticipated it at all. But you're right, Benjamin Franklin's a total outlier. He was very social. He worked very hard at crafting a persona, which is the opposite of most of the other innovators who just really don't care if you like them. They just seem almost physically incapable of moderating their behavior in a way to be liked. Yeah. And, you know, it's about Steve Jobs not showering and staring at people intensely without blinking or even someone like Dean Kamen. Just these people are not self-monitoring at all. And then here's Benjamin Franklin, who's thought very carefully about how to speak in a way that will not arouse opposition. And he's thought very carefully about how to build social networks and how to organize coalitions for things. And it was pretty fascinating. But, you know, ultimately I ended up realizing that, you know, a lot of Benjamin Franklin's inventions were social institutions that mm-hmm. would require a lot of cooperation to make them happen. Mm-hmm. So compared to, say, discovering radium, you know, Marie Curie discovered radium and she held it up and it glowed, and everybody had to agree, oh, my God, you discovered radium. You didn't have to convince people. Its value was readily apparent to everyone. You know, a lot of the things that Benjamin Franklin put together, like street sweeping programs, libraries, and volunteer fire departments, he had to get people to cooperate on these, and the value of them was unknown until they put them together and implemented them, because they had never happened before. You know, so he was just a completely different kind of innovator. He had to be a social innovator because he was innovating social things.
That's an interesting distinction, right? There's the next book, The Social Innovation, because, I didn't realize that he founded the University of Pennsylvania. I mean, like, as like really the first alternative school at the time.
Yeah, and because he had really strong beliefs about the value of basically an agnostic education. And he also, you know, I think what's even more symbolic is the fact that he established one of the first public lending libraries, because his whole life was about books. Hmm. You know, as a kid, he loved books so much, reading and writing. That's why his father decided to indenture him to his brother, who was a printer. And in the printing industry, he could borrow books and read, you know, a much wider variety of books than he could have by his own money, because he would borrow books, and he would actually also save a little money, buy books, read them, and then sell them, and then use that money to buy new books. And he was a completely self-taught person. So for him, you know, books took on this singular importance of advancing humanity, and then he ends up establishing a public lending library, which I think is very beautiful. I think he would be so thrilled that we're digitizing books to make them even more widely available.
Right.
I think that would make him so happy.
I'm curious, did you grow up in a house of books?
You know, not like Benjamin Franklin, but I was a reader.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in the mountains. I grew up in a little cabin. It's funny that you asked this. I grew up in a little cabin up in the mountains, so there were no other kids around. There was no transportation. I was an only child.
Wow.
And, you know, half the time the television didn't work because the antenna would get blown over. So I read a lot. I'm still an obsessive reader. I even read the back of the shampoo bottle.
Yeah. Okay. So where'd you get your books? At the library?
Yeah, at school mostly.
Okay.
I got them mostly from the school library.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, both my wife and I grew up in houses of books, and we had the same thing. Like, it's kind of, you know, pack ratty books everywhere. And both of our kids are both readers, too. But it was never something
wonderful.
That you had to force, because it was just there for you. And that seems to be a somewhat common characteristic, except for occasionally the kid like you or another one who went and just found them if they weren't in the house.
Right. You know what's interesting? Someone asked me the other day if I would move to digital books because, first of all, they wanted to use one of these open-air shared space configurations at the university. And, you know, books take up a lot of room and they collect dust. And I thought about it. I thought, could I just switch to digital books? And I realized that I couldn't. And the reason is that I need the spines of the books up there on the shelf, visual markers of what they contain. Mm-hmm. It's almost like an external memory for me. They serve little cues, and every time I see a title, it reminds me a little bit of what's in that book. And sometimes I'll pull it open and read it again, or at least I know it's there if I need it. But I wouldn't give that up for the world. There's no way I would want to not own physical copies of the books.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's interesting. My wife made the switch, so she is mostly digital, and she's a crazy reader, like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of books. I can't even keep up with her. And I was surprised that she was able to make that switch. But then again, we have so many, you know, in the house, so they're still there. Okay, we're coming close to the end.
But I want to ask her.
Yeah.
Ask one more question.
Go ahead.
Fiction or nonfiction?
Say what?
Does she read fiction or nonfiction?
Mostly fiction, but not exclusively.
Because I wouldn't have to save hard copies of fiction, because fiction is this hedonic experience that I'm just going to experience. I don't need to remember it.
That's interesting.
But nonfiction is a reference to me that I never want to lose.
So, yeah, all right, let's talk about this a little bit. So I really only read fiction until I started this podcast. I would never read nonfiction. And then when I started, you know, interviewing academics and, you know, CEOs and other people and a lot of people who write business books, I jumped into this world. I love it. I'm like, what was I doing? But also, you know, sometimes I miss the stories. So, you know, like I'm halfway through Lincoln and the Bardo by George Saunders, which is beautiful, incredible book of fiction. And I haven't been able to finish it because I've got so much reading to do for the podcast. And the other thing that I noticed is because I've got the podcast, it forces me to read, which is like the best nudge in the world, because it sort of makes you do the thing that, you know, it's our default setting is to often do nothing. And I know in your work, you have to read because you're teaching and all that.
Oh, I'm always reading. Always reading.
Yeah. So it's
reading. You must have liked Quirky because it was stories and it was nonfiction.
Yeah. And it was funny, though. I was having this fight with it because I am all about group creativity. I am all about, you know, collaborative, the group is more important than the individual. And I'm reading stuff and I'm like, okay, got to set that aside. And what I always end up with all this stuff is like the idea that both things can be true, because these things are so nuanced and we tend to sort of easily go into these categories. And one of the things I wanted to mention to you too that I thought was interesting was this idea of all these innovators have long paths of association. So this kind of divergent thinking. And when you understand the cognitive process that someone, when they're improvising or making a joke, what they're doing system one, system two at the same time. You know, so if you think about like if you know where I'm going, it's like that idea of like, you know, the recognition of a joke, which is sort of like, oh, it's this pattern. Oh, you've changed it. You've gone somewhere else, is very similar to an insight. And I was sort of curious, like when you started, and I know we're getting kind of like neuroscience, but it really felt like that was an interesting discovery among these people.
Well, you just brought up three separate things all together as if they were one thing.
Could they be?
I think you have a really important insight there, that the process being funny is a process of making, first you make the regular association in your mind, and then you think what the other possible associations could be, and you find the one that actually connects and yet will be startling, because that's what's often funny, right, is that it's something that it does fit, but it's not what you expected.
Yep, and the thing about in a comedy club, everyone is doing that together. And so you all laugh at the same moment, which is like this other weird thing, right? That's that power of like shared laughter.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something
you
know,
there. That suggests you probably have to be pretty intelligent to be that funny.
Yes, but not traditionally intelligent, which is like this book. You know, like, so I've worked at Second City for about 30 years. So I'm 92 to 2015. So my years were Stephen Colbert, Steve Carell, Amy Sedaris, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Seth Meyers, all those folks. Some of whom are, like Colbert, very traditionally educated. He went to Northwestern with my wife. They were friends there. And then others who, like a Steve Carell, who is sort of bizarrely smart. You know, he's not someone who's necessarily was like walking around with books, but just had like this insight into human nature that then he could sort of redo. And then and I think that's why what's interesting about those comic actors who then become dramatic actors, like Bill Murray has done some of that, which is like, mm-hmm. Oh, my God. They I think one of the things, the reason they touch that nerve is they're able to take, maybe it's some of the empathy we talked about or understanding or insight, and then turn it to like just real human behavior, which sometimes is very sad. Right. Yeah, it's interesting.
Right. Oh, I would love to meet Carell. I think what you're talking about is that, you know, there's a lot of different ways to be intelligent and a lot of different things to be intelligent about.
Yeah, yeah.
But with all of these people, you're describing something that requires what we would call fluency, which is the ability to basically think quickly, to make associations quickly and filter through them quickly. If you couldn't do that, you couldn't be spontaneously funny.
Right. And I think what we also don't recognize is that we can get better at that if we practice it. But there's not a lot of places where we get to practice that.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's the big thing.
Some people are naturally pretty good at it, but other people can learn to get better at it. You know, it's funny, I'm watching The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel right now.
I love that show.
Binge watching it on Amazon Prime. And so a lot of what you're saying is reminding me of that show.
Yeah.
And how quickly she has to think in the show. But of course, she has a script. But
no,
she's playing a realistic character.
Yeah, that's a very realistic show, by the way. And my family loves it, and it is. It's very smart. It's very insightful. It's playing around with a lot of those ideas. And again, what we sort of look at is, especially as you get to be an adult, you don't get to play as often.
Mm-hmm.
And Adam Grant talks about this and other people, the power of play, the power of, just daydreaming, procrastinating, all those things that, you know, we get wired into our tasks, and it's so much worse now in the digital age. Very much where we come into corporate America, and we do a lot of work in that. That's like the biggest division at Second City now, is literally coming in for 3 hours in a company and saying, phones down, we're going to play these exercises, which, you know, are sort of like group mindfulness. It's like sort of everyone getting together playing together, making patterns together, looking at each other in the eye. And then everyone's so charged with that because they realize, oh, they don't get to do that anymore.
That sounds really fun.
Yeah, it's a good time. So, all right. So I've kept you.
Wait, I got to ask you a question real quick.
Okay.
I got to ask you a question real quick.
Go ahead.
You drink a lot of coffee.
Yep.
You do. And how much do you sleep?
I tend to sleep 7 hours a night.
All right. All right. So almost a full normal night.
Yeah. I'm curious where you're going with that.
Well, because the pace at which you talk and the pace at which you think suggests that you might have modestly elevated dopamine, and you can get that from coffee, and you can get it from mania, you can get it from a variety of things, but it'll make you a faster thinker.
That's interesting. I do drink a lot of coffee. I don't think I've got mania. My daughter's in the studio right now, so I'm looking at her. Mania? No? No, she doesn't think so. So,
okay.
That's very interesting. Well, and the other thing, well, I'd also suggest this, though. I work around improvisers. So, like, 3 decades of having to deal with Tina Fey, who is by far... Here's the thing about Tina Fey. Not only is she fast and funny, she can figure out the thing you hate about yourself and use it against you if you wrong her, like, in a moment. Just imagine.
That's wonderful.
Right. But also just imagine being her boss and knowing that that superpower is across the, you know, desk from you. It's terrifying.
Oh, gosh.
You've got to be so far ahead.
That's funny.
Yeah. All right. So I am going to ask you for a yes and story. This is how we end every podcast. And the idea in improvisation is that when you have groups of people making something out of nothing, you can't do it by saying no. And you can't really do it by saying yes, but when you do that, you're saying no with, you know, a bow tie. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm curious, in your life, your work, it can be anything, do you have a yes and story?
I feel like I have a ton of yes and stories.
Good.
Yeah. I mean, one of them was this book because, you know, I'm a research professor, and most of what I do is writing academic articles that go into journals that are mostly read by other academics. And we have a very strict standard of what's considered rigorous and scientific. And frankly, that's the only thing that counts for your career at, mm-hmm. at the kind of school that I'm at. And I started working on this project because I just wanted to. You know, Steve Jobs, I needed to understand how he ticked. And so I started working on him. And then I developed a multiple case study research project. And at some point, it was just physically too big for an article. Mm-hmm. And I was presenting it in a conference, and a colleague of mine said, you know, maybe you should think about a book. And I said, yes, and not an academic book, actually. Like, I ended up not only writing a book, which was not something that I usually did other than, let's say, textbooks, but also taking the book a slightly different direction, bringing it to more of a general audience and wanting it to say things about not just business, but also parenting and really digging into the psychology of these people. So that was a yes and story, I think.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's, and I know that world, right? So we work at the Center for Decision Research at Chicago Booth, and they're constantly talking about the need to be precise in sort of language, and you have to be so careful in these sort of academic journals. But then when you do that, it's not available to regular humans who want to sort of maybe understand right. the stuff. So I really appreciate that about your book.
Oh, thank you. No, it's funny because the publisher renamed the book. You know when you get a contract to publish a book, you don't actually control the title of it. This I hadn't realized. But they changed the title of the book and they put the word traits in there. And I was really afraid because, you know, psychology has very strict rules about the word trait. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people who defend the notion of what counts as a trait and what doesn't. I would have never used the word traits, for instance. But with the book, I learned to let go and say, you know what? It works in the title. Regular people are going to understand what that means. And we're just going to go with it.
What was the original title? Was it quirky or was it something else?
No, it was The Making of a Breakthrough Innovator.
So I wrote a book called Yes And, Lessons from the Second City. That was originally called The Revolution Will Be Improvised.
Oh, I like both of those titles.
Yeah.
I think the first one's easier to understand. I think yours is easier to understand.
Yeah, I liked it. They thought it was a vague reference to Gil Scott-Heron, a like little-known musician. And then when they, this is what happened, actually. HarperCollins was here in town, and they were like, hey, why don't you give an improv workshop to our sales team so they can really understand this stuff? And we taught them the yes-and concept, and these guys couldn't get it out of their heads. They're like, that's the stickiest concept to play with. So that's how we ended up renaming it.
Oh, that's cool. I really fought with my publisher over the title and thing because to me, quirky doesn't really capture it. You know, to me, quirks sound like little ticks or little idiosyncrasies or something. And I saw these as big, huge themes and forces or characteristics. But you know, the publisher won. And then I got a review in the New Yorker, and half the review was about how it was the wrong title.
Oh, no. You got that review?
Yeah.
I didn't see that.
Yeah.
I will say, though, from my end, when I saw the title, and that drew me to, I was like, yes, I was interested in that. And then when I read the book, I'm like, oh, this is like the work of a real academic. It's not, you know, just made-up stories.
Right.
So. I'm going to highly recommend everyone get the book. It's called Quirky. Whether you like the title or not, you should buy it. Melissa Schilling, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun. Well, I've been working in a coal mine.